birds seem to have acquired a kind of nastiness by association, which I regret. It is not that I take back what I said. Selfish short-sightedness still has the undesirable consequences that I mentioned. But nowadays, if one were seeking examples of selfish short-sightedness in Britain, one would not look first at the working class. Actually, it is probably best not to burden a scientific work with political asides at all, since it is remarkable how quickly these date. The writings of politically aware scientists of the 1930s, J.B.S. Haldane and Lancelot Hogben, for instance, are today significantly marred by their anachronistic barbs.
Although the group selection theory now commands little support within the ranks of those professional biologists who understand evolution, it does have great intuitive appeal. Successive generations of zoology students are surprised when they come up from school to find that it is not the orthodox point of view. For this, they're hardly to be blamed, for in The Nuffield Biology Teacher's Guide, written for advanced-level biology school teachers in Britain, we find the following. In higher animals, behaviour may take the form of individual suicide to ensure the survival of the species. The anonymous author of this guide is blissfully ignorant of the fact that he has said something controversial. In this respect, he is in Nobel Prize-winning company. Conrad Lawrence, in his book On Aggression, speaks of the species-preserving functions of aggressive behaviour, one of these functions being to make sure that only the fittest individuals are allowed to breed.
This is a gem of a circular argument, but the point I'm making here is that the group selection idea is so deeply ingrained that Lawrence, like the author of the Nuffield Guide, evidently did not realise that his statements contravened orthodox Darwinian theory. I recently heard a delightful example of the same thing on an otherwise excellent BBC television programme about Australian spiders. The expert on the programme observed that the vast majority of baby spiders end up as prey for other species, and she then went on to say, perhaps this is the real purpose of their existence, as only a few need to survive in order for the species to be preserved. Robert Ardrey, in The Social Contract, used the group selection theory to account for the whole of social order in general. He clearly sees man as a species that has strayed from the path of animal righteousness. Ardrey at least did his homework. His decision to disagree with orthodox theory was a conscious one, and for this he deserves credit. Perhaps one reason for the great appeal of the group selection theory is that it is thoroughly in tune with the moral and political ideals that most of us share. We may frequently behave selfishly as individuals, but in our more idealistic moments, we honour and admire those who put the welfare of others first. We get a bit muddled over how widely we want to interpret the word others, though. Often, altruism within a group goes with selfishness between groups. This is the basis of trade unionism. At another level, the nation is a major beneficiary of our altruistic self-sacrifice, and young men are expected to die as individuals for the greater glory of their country as a whole. Moreover, they are encouraged to kill other individuals about whom nothing is known except that they belong to a different nation. Curiously, peacetime appeals for individuals to make some small sacrifice in the rate at which they increase their standard of living seem to be less effective than wartime appeals for individuals to lay down their lives. Recently, there has been a reaction against racialism and patriotism, and a tendency to substitute the whole human species as the object of our fellow feeling. This humanist broadening of the target of our altruism has an interesting corollary, which again seems to buttress the good of the species idea in evolution. The politically liberal, who are normally the most convinced spokesmen of the species ethic, now often have the greatest scorn for those who've gone a little further in widening their altruism, so that it includes other species. If I say that I am more interested in preventing the slaughter of large whales than I am in improving housing conditions for people, I'm likely to shock some of my friends.
The feeling that members of one's own species deserve special moral consideration as compared with members of other species is old and deep. Killing people outside war is the most seriously regarded crime ordinarily committed. The only thing more strongly forbidden by our culture is eating people, even if they're already dead. We enjoy eating members of other species, however. Many of us shrink from judicial execution of even the most horrible human criminals, while we cheerfully countenance the shooting, without trial, of fairly mild animal pests. Indeed, we kill members of other harmless species as a means of recreation and amusement. A human fetus, with no more human feeling than an amoeba, enjoys a reverence and legal protection far in excess of those granted to an adult chimpanzee. Yet the chimp feels and thinks and, according to recent experimental evidence, may even be capable of learning a form of human language. The fetus belongs to our own species, and is instantly accorded special privileges and rights because of it.
Whether the ethic of speciesism, to use Richard Ryder's term, can be put on a logical footing any more sound than that of racism, I do not know. What I do know is that it has no proper basis in evolutionary biology. The muddle in human ethics over the level at which altruism is desirable, family, nation, race, species, or all living things, is mirrored by a parallel muddle in biology over the level at which altruism is to be expected according to the theory of evolution. Even the group selectionist would not be surprised to find members of rival groups being nasty to each other. In this way, like trade unionists or soldiers, they are favouring their own group in the struggle for limited resources. But then it is worth asking how the group selectionist decides which level is the important one. If selection goes on between groups within a species and between species, why should it not also go on between larger groupings? Species are grouped together into genera, genera into orders, and orders into classes. Lions and antelopes are both members of the class Mammalia, as are we. Should we then not expect lions to refrain from killing antelopes for the good of the mammals? Surely they should hunt birds or reptiles instead, in order to prevent the extinction of the class. But then what of the need to perpetuate the whole phylum of vertebrates? It is all very well for me to argue by reductio ad absurdum and to point to the difficulties of the group selection theory, but the apparent existence of individual altruism still has to be explained. Ardrey goes so far as to say that group selection is the only possible explanation for behaviour such as stotting in Thomson's gazelles. This vigorous and conspicuous leaping in front of a predator is analogous to bird alarm calls, in that it seems to warn companions of danger while apparently calling the predator's attention to the stotter himself. We have a responsibility to explain stotting Tommies and all similar phenomena, and this is something I'm going to face in later chapters. Before that, I must argue for my belief that the best way to look at evolution is in terms of selection occurring at the lowest level of all. In this belief, I am heavily influenced by G.C. Williams' great book, Adaptation and Natural Selection. The central idea I shall make use of was foreshadowed by A. Weismann in pre-gene days at the turn of the century, his doctrine of the continuity of the germplasm. I shall argue that the fundamental unit of selection, and therefore of self-interest, is not the species, nor the group, nor even strictly the individual. It is the gene, the unit of heredity.
To some biologists, this may sound at first like an extreme view, but it is in substance orthodox, even if it is expressed in an unfamiliar way. The argument takes time to develop, and we must begin at the beginning, with the very origin of life itself.
End note. Since writing my manifesto of genic selection, I have had second thoughts about whether there may not also be a kind of higher level selection occasionally operating during the long haul of evolution. I hasten to add that when I say higher level, I do not mean anything to do with group selection. I am talking about something much more subtle and much more interesting. My feeling now is that not only are some individual organisms better at surviving than others, whole classes of organisms may be better at evolving than others. Of course, the evolving that we are talking about here is still the same old evolution, mediated via selection on genes. Mutations are still favoured because of their impact on the survival and reproductive success of individuals. But a major new mutation in basic embryological plan may also open up new floodgates of radiating evolution for millions of years to come. There can be a kind of higher level selection for embryologies that lend themselves to evolution, a selection in favor of evolvability. This kind of selection may even be cumulative and therefore progressive in ways that group selection is not. These ideas are spelt out in my paper, The Evolution of Evolvability, which was largely inspired by playing with Blind Watchmaker, a computer program simulating aspects of evolution.
Chapter 2. The Replicators. In the beginning was simplicity. It is difficult enough explaining how even a simple universe began. It will be even harder to explain the sudden springing up, fully armed, of complex order. Life, or a being capable of creating life. Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection is satisfying because it shows us a way in which simplicity could change into complexity, how unordered atoms could group themselves into ever more complex patterns until they ended up manufacturing people. Darwin provides a solution, the only feasible one so far suggested, to the deep problem of our existence. Let us consider the theory in a more general way than is customary, beginning with the time before evolution itself began. Darwin's survival of the fittest is really a special case of a more general law of survival of the stable. The universe is populated by stable things. A stable thing is a collection of atoms that is permanent enough or common enough to deserve a name. It may be a unique collection of atoms, such as the Matterhorn, that lasts long enough to be worth naming. Or it may be a class of entities, such as raindrops, that come into existence at a sufficiently high rate to deserve a collective name, even if any one of them is short-lived. The things that we see around us, and which we think of as needing explanation, rocks, galaxies, ocean waves, are all, to a greater or lesser extent, stable patterns of atoms. Soap bubbles tend to be spherical because this is a stable configuration for thin films filled with gas. In a spacecraft, water is also stable in spherical globules, but on Earth, where there is gravity, the stable surface for standing water is flat and horizontal. Salt crystals tend to be cubes because this is a stable way of packing sodium and chloride ions together. In the sun, the simplest atoms of all, hydrogen atoms, are fusing to form helium atoms because in the conditions that prevail there, the helium configuration is more stable. Other, even more complex atoms are being formed in stars all over the universe ever since soon after the Big Bang, which, according to the prevailing theory, initiated the universe. This is originally where the elements on our world came from. Sometimes when atoms meet, they link up together in chemical reaction to form molecules which may be more or less stable. Such molecules can be very large. A crystal such as a diamond can be regarded as a single molecule, a proverbially stable one in this case, but also a very simple one since its internal atomic structure is endlessly repeated. In modern living organisms, there are other large molecules which are highly complex, and their complexity shows itself on several levels. The hemoglobin of our blood is a typical protein molecule. It is built up from chains of smaller molecules, amino acids, each containing a few dozen atoms arranged in a precise pattern. In the hemoglobin molecule, there are 574 amino acid molecules. These are arranged in four chains, which twist around each other to form a globular three-dimensional structure of bewildering complexity. A model of a hemoglobin molecule looks rather like a dense thorn bush. But unlike a real thorn bush, it's not a haphazard approximate pattern, but a definite invariant structure, identically repeated, with not a twig nor a twist out of place, over 6,000 million, million, million times in an average human body. The precise thornbush shape of a protein molecule, such as hemoglobin, is stable in the sense that two chains consisting of the same sequences of amino acids will tend, like two springs, to come to rest in exactly the same three-dimensional coiled pattern. Hemoglobin thorn bushes are springing into their preferred shape in your body at a rate of about 400 million million per second, and others are being destroyed at the same rate. Hemoglobin is a modern molecule used to illustrate the principle that atoms tend to fall into stable patterns. The point that is relevant here is that before the coming of life on Earth, some rudimentary evolution of molecules could have occurred by ordinary processes of physics and chemistry. There's no need to think of design or purpose or directedness. If a group of atoms in the presence of energy falls into a stable pattern, it will tend to stay that way. The earliest form of natural selection was simply a selection of stable forms and a rejection of unstable ones. There's no mystery about this. It had to happen by definition. From this, of course, it does not follow that you can explain the existence of entities as complex as man by exactly the same principles on their own. It's no good taking the right number of atoms and shaking them together with some external energy till they happen to fall into the right pattern and out drops Adam. You may make a molecule consisting of a few dozen atoms like that, but a man consists of over 1,000,000,000,000,000,000 atoms. To try to make a man, you would have to work at your biochemical cocktail shaker for a period so long that the entire age of the universe would seem like an eye blink, and even then you would not succeed. This is where Darwin's theory, in its most general form, comes to the rescue. Darwin's theory takes over from where the story of the slow building up of molecules leaves off. The account of the origin of life given here is necessarily speculative. By definition, nobody was around to see what happened. There are a number of rival theories, but they all have certain features in common.
End note. Here I have chosen just one to illustrate the main idea. But I wouldn't wish to give the impression that this was the only serious candidate, or even the best one. Indeed, in The Blind Watchmaker, I deliberately chose a different one for the same purpose, A.G. Cairns-Smith's clay theory. In neither book did I commit myself to the particular hypothesis chosen. If I wrote another book, I should probably take the opportunity to try to explain yet another viewpoint, that of the German mathematical chemist Manfred Eigen and his colleagues. What I'm always trying to get over is something about the fundamental properties that must lie at the heart of any good theory of the origin of life on any planet, notably the idea of self-replicating genetic entities.
This simplified account which follows now is probably not too far from the truth. We do not know what chemical raw materials were abundant on Earth before the coming of life, but among the plausible possibilities are water, carbon dioxide, methane and ammonia, all simple compounds known to be present on at least some of the other planets in our solar system. Chemists have tried to imitate the chemical conditions of the young Earth. They've put these simple substances in a flask and supplied a source of energy such as ultraviolet light or electric sparks, artificial simulation of primordial lightning. After a few weeks of this, something interesting is usually found inside the flask, a weak brown soup containing a large number of molecules more complex than the ones originally put in. In particular, amino acids have been found, the building blocks of proteins, one of the two great classes of biological molecules. Before these experiments were done, naturally occurring amino acids would have been thought of as diagnostic of the presence of life. If they had been detected on, say, Mars, life on that planet would have seemed a near certainty. Now, however, their existence need imply only the presence of a few simple gases in the atmosphere and some volcanoes, sunlight, or thundery weather. More recently, laboratory simulations of the chemical conditions of Earth before the coming of life have yielded organic substances called purines and pyrimidines. These are building blocks of the genetic molecule DNA itself. Processes analogous to these must have given rise to the primeval soup which biologists and chemists believe constituted the seas some 3 or 4 thousand million years ago. The organic substances became locally concentrated, perhaps in drying scum round the shores or in tiny suspended droplets. Under the further influence of energy such as ultraviolet light from the sun, they combined into larger molecules. Nowadays, large organic molecules would not last long enough to be noticed. They would be quickly absorbed and broken down by bacteria or other living creatures. But bacteria and the rest of us are latecomers, and in those days, large organic molecules could drift unmolested through the thickening broth. At some point, a particularly remarkable molecule was formed by accident. We will call it the replicator. It may not necessarily have been the biggest or the most complex molecule around, but it had the extraordinary property of being able to create copies of itself. This may seem a very unlikely sort of accident to happen, so it was. It was exceedingly improbable. In the lifetime of a man, things that are that improbable can be treated, for practical purposes, as impossible. That is why you will never win a big prize on the football pools. But in our human estimates of what is probable and what is not, we're not used to dealing in hundreds of millions of years. If you filled in pools coupons every week for 100 million years, you would very likely win several jackpots. Actually, a molecule that makes copies of itself is not as difficult to imagine as it seems at first, and it only had to arise once. Think of the replicator as a mould or template. Imagine it as a large molecule consisting of a complex chain of various sorts of building block molecules. The small building blocks were abundantly available in the soup surrounding the replicator. Now suppose that each building block has an affinity for its own kind. Then, whenever a building block from out in the soup lands up next to a part of the replicator for which it has an affinity, it will tend to stick there. The building blocks that attach themselves in this way will automatically be arranged in a sequence that mimics that of the replicator itself. It is easy then to think of them joining up to form a stable chain, just as in the formation of the original replicator. This process could continue as a progressive stacking up, layer upon layer. This is how crystals are formed. On the other hand, the two chains might split apart, in which case we have two replicators, each of which can go on to make further copies. A more complex possibility is that each building block has affinity not for its own kind, but reciprocally for one particular other kind. Then the replicator would act as a template not for an identical copy, but for a kind of negative, which would in its turn remake an exact copy of the original positive. For our purposes, it does not matter whether the original replication process was positive-negative or positive-positive, though it is worth remarking that the modern equivalents of the first replicator, the DNA molecules, use positive-negative replication. What does matter is that suddenly a new kind of stability came into the world. Previously, it is probable that no particular kind of complex molecule was very abundant in the soup, because each was dependent on building blocks happening to fall, by luck, into a particular stable configuration. As soon as the replicator was born, it must have spread its copies rapidly throughout the seas until the smaller building block molecules became a scarce resource and other larger molecules were formed more and more rarely.
So we seem to arrive at a large population of identical replicas. But now we must mention an important property of any copying process. It is not perfect. Mistakes will happen. I hope there are no misprints in this book, but there may be one or two. They will probably not seriously distort the meaning of the sentences, because they will be first-generation errors. But imagine the days before printing, when books such as the Gospels were copied by hand. All scribes, however careful, are bound to make a few errors, and some are not above a little willful improvement. If they all copied from a single master original, meaning would not be greatly perverted. but let copies be made from other copies, which in their turn were made from other copies, and errors will start to become cumulative and serious.
We tend to regard erratic copying as a bad thing, and in the case of human documents, it's hard to think of examples where errors can be described as improvements. The scholars of the Septuagint could at least be said to have started something big when they mistranslated the Hebrew word for young woman into the Greek word for virgin, coming up with the prophecy, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son."
End note. Several distressed correspondents have queried this mistranslation and have demanded a reply from me. Hurting religious sensibilities is a perilous business these days, so I'd better oblige. Actually, it is a pleasure, for scientists can't often get satisfyingly dusty in the library, indulging in a real academic footnote. The point is in fact well known to biblical scholars, and not disputed by them. The Hebrew word in Isaiah is Alma, which undisputedly means young woman, with no implication of virginity. If virgin had been intended, Bethula could have been used instead. The ambiguous English word maiden illustrates how easy it can be to slide between the two meanings. The mutation occurred when the pre-Christian Greek translation known as the Septuagint rendered Alma into Parthenos, which really does usually mean virgin. Matthew, not of course the apostle and contemporary of Jesus, but the gospel maker writing long afterwards, quoted Isaiah in what seems to be a derivative of the Septuagint version. All but two of the 15 Greek words are identical, when he said,
"Now all this was done that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel."
That is the authorized English translation. It is widely accepted among Christian scholars that the story of the virgin birth of Jesus was a late interpolation, put in presumably by Greek-speaking disciples in order that the mistranslated prophecy should be seen to be fulfilled. Modern versions such as the New English Bible correctly give young woman in Isaiah. They equally correctly leave virgin in Matthew, since they are translating from his Greek.
Anyway, as we shall see, erratic copying in biological replicators can, in a real sense, give rise to improvement, and it was essential for the progressive evolution of life that some errors were made. We do not know how accurately the original replicator molecules made their copies. Their modern descendants, the DNA molecules, are astonishingly faithful compared with the most high-fidelity human copying process, but even they occasionally make mistakes, and it is ultimately these mistakes that make evolution possible. Probably the original replicators were far more erratic, but in any case we may be sure that mistakes were made, and these mistakes were cumulative. As miscopyings were made and propagated, the primeval soup became filled by a population not of identical replicas, but of several varieties of replicating molecules, all descended from the same ancestor. Would some varieties have been more numerous than others? Almost certainly yes. Some varieties would have been inherently more stable than others. Certain molecules once formed would be less likely than others to break up again. These types will become relatively numerous in the soup, not only as a direct logical consequence of their longevity, but also because they would have a long time available for making copies of themselves. Replicators of high longevity would therefore tend to become more numerous and, other things being equal, there would have been an evolutionary trend towards greater longevity in the population of molecules.
But other things were probably not equal. And another property of a replicator variety that must have had even more importance in spreading it through the population was speed of replication or fecundity. If replicator molecules of type A make copies of themselves on average once a week, while those of type B make copies of themselves once an hour, it is not difficult to see that pretty soon type A molecules are going to be far outnumbered, even if they live much longer than B molecules. There would therefore probably have been an evolutionary trend towards higher fecundity of molecules in the soup. A third characteristic of replicator molecules, which would have been positively selected, is accuracy of replication. If molecules of type X and type Y last the same length of time and replicate at the same rate, but X makes a mistake on average every 10th replication, while Y makes a mistake only every 100th replication, Y will obviously become more numerous. The X contingent in the population loses not only the errant children themselves, but also all their descendants, actual or potential. If you already know something about evolution, you may find something slightly paradoxical about the last point. Can we reconcile the idea that copying errors are an essential prerequisite for evolution to occur with the statement that natural selection favors high copying fidelity? The answer is that although evolution may seem, in some vague sense, a good thing, especially since we are the product of it, nothing actually wants to evolve. Evolution is something that happens, willy-nilly, in spite of all the efforts of the replicators, and nowadays of the genes, to prevent it happening. Jacques Monod made this point very well in his Herbert Spencer lecture, after wryly remarking, "Another curious aspect of the theory of evolution is that everybody thinks he understands it."
To return to the primeval soup, it must have become populated by stable varieties of molecule, stable in that either the individual molecules lasted a long time, or they replicated rapidly, or they replicated accurately. Evolutionary trends towards these three kinds of stability took place in the following sense. If you had sampled the soup at two different times, the later sample would have contained a higher proportion of varieties with high longevity, fecundity, copying fidelity. This is essentially what a biologist means by evolution when he is speaking of living creatures, and the mechanism is the same, natural selection.
Should we then call the original replicator molecules living? Who cares? I might say to you, Darwin was the greatest man who has ever lived, and you might say, no, Newton was. But I hope we would not prolong the argument. The point is that no conclusion of substance would be affected whichever way our argument was resolved. The facts of the lives and achievements of Newton and Darwin remain totally unchanged, whether we label them great or not. Similarly, the story of the replicator molecules probably happens something like the way I am telling it, regardless of whether we choose to call them living. Human suffering has been caused because too many of us cannot grasp that words are only tools for our use, and that the mere presence in the dictionary of a word like living does not mean it necessarily has to refer to something definite in the real world. Whether we call the early replicators living or not, they were the ancestors of life. They were our founding fathers.
The next important link in the argument, one that Darwin himself laid stress on, although he was talking about animals and plants, not molecules, is competition. The primeval soup was not capable of supporting an infinite number of replicator molecules. For one thing, the Earth's size is finite, but other limiting factors must also have been important. In our picture of the replicator acting as a template or mould, we supposed it to be bathed in a soup rich in the small building block molecules necessary to make copies. But when the replicators became numerous, building blocks must have been used up at such a rate that they became a scarce and precious resource. Different varieties or strains of replicator must have competed for them. We have considered the factors that would have increased the numbers of favoured kinds of replicator. We can now see that less favoured varieties must actually have become less numerous because of competition, and ultimately many of their lines must have gone extinct. There was a struggle for existence among replicator varieties. They did not know they were struggling or worry about it. The struggle was conducted without any hard feelings, indeed without feelings of any kind. But they were struggling in the sense that any miscopying that resulted in a new higher level of stability or a new way of reducing the stability of rivals was automatically preserved and multiplied. The process of improvement was cumulative. Ways of increasing stability and of decreasing rival stability became more elaborate and more efficient. Some of them may even have discovered how to break up molecules of rival varieties chemically and to use the building blocks so released for making their own copies. These proto-carnivores simultaneously obtained food and removed competing rivals. Other replicators perhaps discovered how to protect themselves, either chemically or by building a physical wall of protein around themselves. This may have been how the first living cells appeared. Replicators began not merely to exist, but to construct for themselves containers, vehicles for their continued existence. The replicators that survived were the ones that built survival machines for themselves to live in. The first survival machines probably consisted of nothing more than a protective coat, but making a living got steadily harder as new rivals arose with better and more effective survival machines. Survival machines got bigger and more elaborate, and the process was cumulative and progressive. Was there to be any end to the gradual improvement in the techniques and artifices used by the replicators to ensure their own continuation in the world? There would be plenty of time for improvement. What weird engines of self-preservation would the millennia bring forth? 4,000 million years on, what was to be the fate of the ancient replicators? They did not die out, for they are past masters of the survival arts. But do not look for them floating loose in the sea. They gave up that cavalier freedom long ago. Now they swarm in huge colonies, safe inside gigantic lumbering robots, sealed off from the outside world, communicating with it by tortuous indirect routes, manipulating it by remote control. They are in you and in me. They created us, body and mind, and their preservation is the ultimate rationale for our existence. They have come a long way, those replicators. Now they go by the name of genes, and we are their survival machines.
End note. This purple passage, a rare, well, fairly rare indulgence, with which I end this chapter, has been quoted and requoted in gleeful evidence of my rabid genetic determinism. Part of the problem lies with the popular but erroneous associations of the word robot. We are in the golden age of electronics, and robots are no longer rigidly inflexible morons, but are capable of learning, intelligence, and creativity. Ironically, even as long ago as 1920, when Carol Capek coined the word, robots were mechanical beings that ended up with human feelings, like falling in love. People who think that robots are by definition more deterministic than human beings are muddled, unless they are religious, in which case they might consistently hold that humans have some divine gift of free will denied to mere machines. If, like most of the critics of my lumbering robot passage, you are not religious, then face up to the following question. What on earth do you think you are, if not a robot, albeit a very complicated one? I've discussed all this in my book, The Extended Phenotype. The error has been compounded by yet another telling mutation. Just as it seemed theologically necessary that Jesus should have been born of a virgin, so it seems demonologically necessary that any genetic determinist worth his salt must believe that genes control every aspect of our behavior. I wrote of the genetic replicators, they created us, body and mind. This has been duly misquoted, for example in Not in Our Genes by Rose, Kamin and Lewontin, and previously in a scholarly paper by Lewontin, as they control us, body and mind. In the context of my chapter, I think it is obvious what I meant by created, and it is very different from control. Anybody can see that as a matter of fact, genes do not control their creations in the strong sense criticized as determinism. We effortlessly, well, fairly effortlessly, defy them every time we use contraception.
Chapter 3. Immortal Coils. We are survival machines, but we does not mean just people. It embraces all animals, plants, bacteria, and viruses. The total number of survival machines on Earth is very difficult to count, and even the total number of species is unknown. Taking just insects alone, the number of living species has been estimated at around 3 million, and the number of individual insects may be 1 million, million, million. Different sorts of survival machine appear very varied on the outside and in their internal organs. An octopus is nothing like a mouse, and both are quite different from an oak tree. Yet in their fundamental chemistry, they're rather uniform, and in particular, the replicators that they bear, the genes, are basically the same kind of molecule in all of us, from bacteria to elephants. We are all survival machines for the same kind of replicator, molecules called DNA, but there are many different ways of making a living in the world, and the replicators have built a vast range of machines to exploit them. A monkey is a machine that preserves genes up trees. A fish is a machine that preserves genes in the water. There's even a small worm that preserves genes in German beer mats. DNA works in mysterious ways.
For simplicity, I've given the impression that modern genes made of DNA are much the same as the first replicators in the primeval soup. It does not matter for the argument, but this may not really be true. The original replicators may have been a related kind of molecule to DNA, or they may have been totally different. In the latter case, we might say that their survival machines must have been seized at a later stage by DNA. If so, the original replicators were utterly destroyed, for no trace of them remains in modern survival machines. Along these lines, A.G. Cairns-Smith has made the intriguing suggestion that our ancestors, the first replicators, may have been not organic molecules at all, but inorganic crystals, minerals, little bits of clay. Usurper or not, DNA is in undisputed charge today, unless, as I tentatively suggest in Chapter 11, a new seizure of power is now just beginning.
A DNA molecule is a long chain of building blocks, small molecules called nucleotides. Just as protein molecules are chains of amino acids, so DNA molecules are chains of nucleotides. A DNA molecule is too small to be seen, but its exact shape has been ingeniously worked out by indirect means. It consists of a pair of nucleotide chains twisted together in an elegant spiral. The double helix, the immortal coil. The nucleotide building blocks come in only 4 different kinds, whose names may be shortened to A, T, C, and G. These are the same in all animals and plants. What differs is the order in which they're strung together. A G building block from a man is identical in every particular to a G building block from a snail. But the sequence of building blocks in a man is not only different from that in a snail, it's also different, though less so, from the sequence in every other man, except in the special case of identical twins. Our DNA lives inside our bodies. It is not concentrated in a particular part of the body, but is distributed among the cells. There are about 1,000 million, million cells making up an average human body, and with some exceptions which we can ignore, every one of those cells contains a complete copy of that body's DNA. This DNA can be regarded as a set of instructions for how to make a body, written in the A, T, C, G alphabet of the nucleotides. It is as though in every room of a gigantic building there was a bookcase containing the architect's plans for the entire building. The bookcase, in a cell, is called the nucleus. The architect's plans run to 46 volumes in man. The number is different in other species. The volumes are called chromosomes. They are visible under a microscope as long threads, and the genes are strung out along them in order. It's not easy, indeed, it may not even be meaningful, to decide where one gene ends and the next one begins. Fortunately, as this chapter will show, this does not matter for our purposes.
I shall make use of the metaphor of the architect's plans, freely mixing the language of the metaphor with the language of the real thing. Volume will be used interchangeably with chromosome. Page will provisionally be used interchangeably with gene, although the division between genes is less clear-cut than the division between the pages of a book. this metaphor will take us quite a long way. When it finally breaks down, I shall introduce other metaphors. Incidentally, there is, of course, no architect. The DNA instructions have been assembled by natural selection.
DNA molecules do two important things. Firstly, they replicate, that is to say, they make copies of themselves. This has gone on non-stop ever since the beginning of life, and the DNA molecules are now very good at it indeed. As an adult, you consist of 1,000,000,000,000 cells, but when you were first conceived, you were just a single cell, endowed with one master copy of the architect's plans. This cell divided into two, and each of the two cells received its own copy of the plans. Successive divisions took the number of cells up to 4, 8, 16, 32, and so on into the billions. At every division, the DNA plans were faithfully copied with scarcely any mistakes. It is one thing to speak of the duplication of DNA, but if the DNA is really a set of plans for building a body, how are the plans put into practice? How are they translated into the fabric of the body? This brings us to the second important thing DNA does. It indirectly supervises the manufacture of a different kind of molecule, protein. The hemoglobin, which was mentioned in the last chapter, is just one example of the enormous range of protein molecules. The coded message of the DNA, written in the four-letter nucleotide alphabet, is translated in a simple mechanical way into another alphabet. This is the alphabet of amino acids, which spells out protein molecules. Making proteins may seem a far cry from making a body, but it is the first small step in that direction. Proteins not only constitute much of the physical fabric of the body, they also exert sensitive control over all the chemical processes inside the cell, selectively turning them on and off at precise times and in precise places. Exactly how this eventually leads to the development of a baby is a story which it will take decades, perhaps centuries, for embryologists to work out. But it is a fact that it does. Genes do indirectly control the manufacture of bodies, and the influence is strictly one way. Acquired characteristics are not inherited. No matter how much knowledge and wisdom you acquire during your life, not one jot will be passed on to your children by genetic means. Each new generation starts from scratch. A body is the gene's way of preserving the genes unaltered.
The evolutionary importance of the fact that genes control embryonic development is this. It means that genes are at least partly responsible for their own survival in the future. Because their survival depends on the efficiency of the bodies in which they live and which they help to build. Once upon a time, natural selection consisted of the differential survival of replicators floating free in the primeval soup. Now, natural selection favors replicators that are good at building survival machines, genes that are skilled in the art of controlling embryonic development. In this, the replicators are no more conscious or purposeful than they ever were. The same old processes of automatic selection between rival molecules by reason of their longevity, fecundity, and copying fidelity still go on as blindly and as inevitably as they did in the far-off days. Genes have no foresight. They do not plan ahead. Genes just are, some genes more so than others, and that is all there is to it. But the qualities that determine a gene's longevity and fecundity are not so simple as they were. Not by a long way.
In recent years, the last 600 million or so, the replicators have achieved notable triumphs of survival machine technology, such as the muscle, the heart, and the eye, evolved several times independently. Before that, they radically altered fundamental features of their way of life as replicators, which must be understood if we are to proceed with the argument. The first thing to grasp about a modern replicator is that it is highly gregarious. A survival machine is a vehicle containing not just one gene, but many thousands. The manufacture of a body is a cooperative venture of such intricacy that it's almost impossible to disentangle the contribution of one gene from that of another.
End note. Here, and also in Chapter 5, is my answer to critics of genetic atomism. Strictly, it is an anticipation, not an answer, since it predates the criticism. I am sorry that it will be necessary to quote myself so fully, but the relevant passages of the selfish gene seem to be disquietingly easy to miss. For example, S.J. Gould stated in his book, The Panda's Thumb,
"There is no gene for such unambiguous bits of morphology as your left kneecap or your fingernail. Bodies cannot be atomized into parts, each constructed by an individual gene. Hundreds of genes contribute to the building of most body parts."
Gould wrote that in a criticism of the selfish gene. But you will shortly hear my actual words. The manufacture of a body is a cooperative venture of such intricacy that it is almost impossible to disentangle the contribution of one gene from that of another. A given gene will have many different effects on quite different parts of the body. A given part of the body will be influenced by many genes, and the effect of any one gene depends on interaction with many others. And later, however independent and free genes may be in their journey through the generations, they are very much not free and independent agents in their control of embryonic development. They collaborate and interact in inextricably complex ways, both with each other and with their external environment. Expressions like gene for long legs or gene for altruistic behavior are convenient figures of speech, but it is important to understand what they mean. There is no gene which single-handedly builds a leg, long or short. Building a leg is a multi-gene cooperative enterprise. Influences from the external environment, too, are indispensable. After all, legs are actually made of food. But there may well be a single gene which, other things being equal, tends to make legs longer than they would have been under the influence of the gene's alternative. I amplified the point in my next paragraph by an analogy with the effects of fertilizer on the growth of wheat. It is almost as though Gould was so sure in advance that I must be a naive atomist that he overlooked the extensive passages in which I made exactly the same interactionist point as he was later to insist upon.
A given gene will have many different effects on quite different parts of the body. A given part of the body will be influenced by many genes, and the effect of any one gene depends on interaction with many others. Some genes act as master genes controlling the operation of a cluster of other genes. In terms of the analogy, any given page of the plans makes reference to many different parts of the building, and each page makes sense only in terms of cross-references to numerous other pages. This intricate interdependence of genes may make you wonder why we use the word gene at all. Why not use a collective noun like gene complex? The answer is that for many purposes that is indeed quite a good idea. But if we look at things in another way, it does make sense too to think of the gene complex as being divided up into discrete replicators, or genes. This arises because of the phenomenon of sex. Sexual reproduction has the effect of mixing and shuffling genes. This means that any one individual body is just a temporary vehicle for a short-lived combination of genes. The combination of genes that is any one individual may be short-lived, but the genes themselves are potentially very long-lived. Their paths constantly cross and recross down the generations. One gene may be regarded as a unit that survives through a large number of successive individual bodies.
This is the central argument that will be developed in this chapter. It is an argument that some of my most respected colleagues obstinately refuse to agree with, so you must forgive me if I seem to labour it. First, I must briefly explain the facts of sex. I said that the plans for building a human body are spelt out in 46 volumes. In fact, this was an oversimplification. The truth is rather bizarre. The 46 chromosomes consist of 23 pairs of chromosomes. we might say that, filed away in the nucleus of every cell, are two alternative sets of 23 volumes of plans. Call them Volume 1A and Volume 1B, Volume 2A and Volume 2B, etc., down to Volume 23A and Volume 23B. Of course, the identifying numbers I use for volumes and later pages are purely arbitrary. We receive each chromosome intact from one of our two parents, in whose testis or ovary it was assembled. Volumes 1A, 2A, 3A, and so on came, say, from the father. Volumes 1B, 2B, 3B, etc. came from the mother. It is very difficult in practice, but in theory, you could look with a microscope at the 46 chromosomes in any one of your cells and pick out the 23 that came from your father and the 23 that came from your mother. The paired chromosomes do not spend all their lives physically in contact with each other, or even near each other. In what sense, then, are they paired? In the sense that each volume coming originally from the father can be regarded, page for page, as a direct alternative to one particular volume coming originally from the mother. For instance, page 6 of volume 13A and page 6 of volume 13B might both be about eye colour. Perhaps one says blue, while the other says brown.
Sometimes the two alternative pages are identical, but in other cases, as in our example of eye colour, they differ. If they make contradictory recommendations, what does the body do? The answer varies. Sometimes one reading prevails over the other. In the eye colour example just given, the person would actually have brown eyes. The instructions for making blue eyes will be ignored in the building of the body, though this does not stop them being passed on to future generations. A gene that is ignored in this way is called recessive. The opposite of a recessive gene is a dominant gene. The gene for brown eyes is dominant to the gene for blue eyes. A person has blue eyes only if both copies of the relevant page are unanimous in recommending blue eyes. More usually, when two alternative genes are not identical, the result is some kind of compromise. The body is built to an intermediate design, or something completely different. When two genes, like the brown eye and the blue eye gene, are rivals for the same slot on a chromosome, they are called alleles of each other. For our purposes, the word allele is synonymous with rival. Imagine the volumes of architects' plans as being loose-leaf binders whose pages can be detached and interchanged. Every volume 13 must have a page 6, but there are several possible page 6s which could go in the binder between page 5 and page 7. One version says blue eyes, another possible version says brown eyes. There may be yet other versions in the population at large which spell out other colours like green. Perhaps there are half a dozen alternative alleles sitting in the page 6 position on the 13th chromosomes scattered around the population as a whole. Any given person only has two volume 13 chromosomes. Therefore, he can have a maximum of two alleles in the page 6 slot. He may, like a blue-eyed person, have two copies of the same allele, or he may have any two alleles chosen from the half dozen alternatives available in the population at large. You cannot, of course, literally go and choose your genes from a pool of genes available to the whole population. At any given time, all the genes are tied up inside individual survival machines. Our genes are doled out to us at conception, and there is nothing we can do about this. Nevertheless, there is a sense in which, in the long term, the genes of the population in general can be regarded as a gene pool. This phrase is in fact a technical term used by geneticists. The gene pool is a worthwhile abstraction because sex mixes genes up, albeit in a carefully organized way. In particular, something like the detaching and interchanging of pages and wads of pages from loose-leaf binders really does go on, as we shall presently see.
I have described the normal division of a cell into two new cells, each one receiving a complete copy of all 46 chromosomes. This normal cell division is called mitosis. But there is another kind of cell division called meiosis. This occurs only in the production of the sex cells, the sperms or eggs. Sperms and eggs are unique among our cells in that, instead of containing 46 chromosomes, they only contain 23. This is, of course, exactly half of 46, convenient when they fuse in sexual fertilization to make a new individual.